WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV with your host, Rebecca Terrell. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. And now, here's your host, Rebecca Terrell.
To The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Yesterday, a YouTuber captured something interesting in the sky above Montana.
Well, hello, everybody. I am sitting in my driveway here in Billings, Montana. And right now, there is a ground stop on our airport. And this thing is up in the sky.
U.S. military officials identified it as a Chinese spy balloon. Disappointing anyone hoping for a Martian invasion, the aircraft was as big as three buses. Balloons of this kind are designed to collect sensitive information, and this one launched by the Chinese apparently represents part of their intelligence gathering arsenal. The Pentagon considered shooting it down, but hesitated due to fears of falling balloon parts. And joining me now is The New American commentator, Daniel Natal. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about this Chinese spy balloon. I don't know what you thought when you first saw it, but my first thought was, that's no moon. That's a space station.
Yeah, exactly. It's sad. Like in the olden days, when we talked about unidentified flying objects, they would explain it as like a balloon, a weather balloon or something. Right. And China's trying to explain it like that now. They're trying to say that it is a civilian craft that was blown off course and it has nothing to do with the Chinese Communist Party. This kind of plays into a story that we talked about, I think yesterday it might have been, regarding the chip war. The United States is trying to choke off microchips to China, and they enlisted Japan and the Netherlands to basically agree to shut off all equipment making so that China is basically enfeebled, not just economically, but for those intercontinental ballistic missiles that they would need to attack the United States. So now, without intercontinental ballistic missiles, we start seeing balloons floating over the United States and floating over Malmstrom Air Force Base, floating over nuclear facilities.
Right.
And so it shut down the traffic there for 2 days. And it kind of also plays into another news item where they had, if I may, I'm probably talking way too long, but there was an Air Force general maybe 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And his name, I think, was Mike Miniver, if I'm not mistaken. And he was talking about, he sent a memo through his chain of command saying, prepare for war with China by 2025. And right. What was different about this was it went beyond scuttlebutt. It went beyond just kind of a hypothetical. And he was telling the people within his chain of command to get ready. Right. So what we're seeing here is there was a Gerald Celente, the economist, he said it comes in these waves. It's a trade war, currency war, world war. And so if you look at it through Trump was trade war with China. Mm-hmm. Biden, through the rate hikes that he's doing and the currency devaluation, is currency war. What comes next?
What comes next? Exactly. And yet they're saying, oh, that's just a little helium balloon that got away. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. So that's a scary prognostication. But anyway, let's move right along with our headlines today. Project Veritas released a new video yesterday featuring Jordan Walker of Pfizer. Going viral overnight, the video highlights the potential for reproductive harm posed by COVID jabs.
Something irregular about the menstrual cycle, so people will have to investigate that, number one.
Yeah.
Because that is a little concerning. Because, like, if you think about
tonight,
the science, like, it shouldn't be
interactive,
like, you know, that. It's called, like, the hypothalamus, pituitary gonadal axis.
Right.
Like, you know, the hormones are, like, their menstrual cycles and things like that. It actually shouldn't be interfering with that, so we don't know.
It shouldn't?
It shouldn't, like, no.
But is it?
There's something happening, but we don't know if it's around.
Well, I mean, you're a urologist, so you must understand, like, what's going on with it, right? Like,
so that's why I just said that it's weird.
And Daniel, this ties in too with breaking news out of Thailand. I know that we were talking before the show about the princess in Thailand, and the royal family has come out now with guns aimed at Pfizer because the princess is still in that coma since, I think, December, isn't it?
Yeah, and so there was just a video that was viral regarding a doctor named Susharit Bhakti. I had to write it down, and so he was basically telling the royal family. He said that he talked to top officials at the, you know, the kind of their health ministry. And he said that he basically made a claim. He laid out that what he said was that the whole COVID thing was a fraud, quote unquote, and that the safety studies had never been done. And moreover, they didn't think that it was necessary to do safety studies. And he said that when he said this, that the health ministers like hit the roof and that they declared that Thailand would be the first country in the war in the world to declare, you know, these Pfizer contracts null and void.
Absolutely, because they had told the royal family at first that her heart ailment had something to do with a bacterial infection, but now it comes out that it had nothing to do with any kind of an infection. And, you know, our own Alex Newman interviewed, Dr. Bhakti is the one who early in the vaccine rollout came out saying, this is bad, this is going to kill people. And, of course, the major media shut him down. Alex Newman interviewed him early in the vaccine rollout. That interview is so great. It's available at thenewamerican.com. I urge everybody to listen to it because he explained at that time exactly what the vaccine was going to accomplish inside our bloodstream and why it was going to cause all these heart problems, you know, the myocarditis that we're seeing, the heart attacks and all this other
neurodegenerative stuff. And to the Project Veritas's point, the fertility issues that it's causing, you know, the problems with women's menstrual cycles and miscarriages and stuff. And so, I mean, somebody made the point, I think it was Steve Kirsch, a Democrat and a man of the left, and he's been going off reservation because he sees the same thing that Bhakti sees, Dr. Bhakti. And he said, you know, isn't it coincidental that Albert Bourla, the CEO of Pfizer, is a veterinarian and his specialty was sterilizing animals? He was like, what a coincidence. You can't make this up.
Wow. That is crazy. Yeah, it's so apparent. I'm glad that so many people are being red pilled. I mean, that's if there's a silver lining to all this, it's that people are waking up. I hope it's not too late. All right. So yeah, exactly. moving right along in our headlines, at an event commemorating the Battle of Stalingrad, Vladimir Putin spoke yesterday to an audience in Volgograd. He told an audience of loyalists that it is remarkable the Russians are again threatened by German Leopard tanks.
Those who plan to defeat.
He spoke in fiery terms about confrontation with the West. Putin foe Nikki Haley declared this week she has a big announcement to make soon. The former governor of South Carolina and UN ambassador is expected to launch her campaign for president. An inheritor of the neoconservative mantle, she has taken a strong stance against Iran and Syria and is a favorite of the Bush family. Though a conservative, she hasn't shied away from divisive identity politics. Referencing Margaret Thatcher's quote, "If you want something done, ask a woman," in the title of her most recent book, she has declared she was told she's too female and too brown to succeed. Famous for removing the Confederate battle flag from the South Carolina state capitol, it was Nikki Haley who declared after the death of George Floyd that in order to heal, it needs to be personal and painful for everyone. Hunter Biden is playing offense and fighting back against his critics. His lawyers have been sending letters this week as part of a demand the IRS and government prosecutors go after those who illegally distributed Mr. Biden's files. Interestingly, by taking this approach with the so-called Russian disinformation laptop, the younger Mr. Biden seems to be acknowledging that the contents of the computer were, in fact, Mr. Biden's files. If you recall, the New York Post was banned from Twitter for reporting on Hunter Biden's laptop, and 50 intelligence officials went on record to declare the Hunter Biden laptop part of a Russian disinformation campaign. Now that the truth is out, we can call the efforts of U.S. officials prior to the 2020 election part of a domestic propaganda operation. Sure seems that way. A Canadian farmer has offered to take Justin Trudeau and Rob Ford to dinner to discuss legal requirements that he dump 30,000 liters of so-called surplus milk. And as far as we know, Mr. Trudeau has not taken him up on his invitation. 25 Republican attorney generals this week sued the Labor Department over a Biden regulation that directs the financial sector to invest more of the public's retirement savings into ESG-compliant accounts. For those not familiar with ESG, the New American's Alex Newman recently took a close look at the topic in an episode of his Behind the Deep State series.
The benefits of the greenhouse gas monitoring infrastructure, which we try to implement now, is that first, the stakeholders, the parties to Paris Agreement, do need information. which is globally consistent. And we can develop this information with this new infrastructure. Second is that we need to understand what happens with the climate system to support the mitigation. And the understanding of the global fluxes will help you with that. So it's not just anthropogenic emissions, but what your forests are doing, what the ocean is doing. We need this information to support our mitigations because we have no time to lose.
Now, to discuss the ESG agenda and everything else in the news, I'll call Daniel Natal back onto the screen with us.
Yeah, I actually wrote a book, Actionable Ethics and a Practical Guide to ESG. So if anybody wants to get that. ESG basically, for the audience, it stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance. And it's basically used as a suite of metrics to what they say, what they claim is to gauge the social impact of companies, institutions, nation states, instead of GDP. So on the surface of it, it sounds good that, you know, we would basically be looking at society's success, not based on Zimbabwe bucks, but based on actual wealth, like clean water, clean air, wheat in fields. Like, this is the real wealth of a society. And too many times societies kind of forego their actual wealth for GDP, and they end up being smoking craters. So that's the surface level. Of course, in reality, what happened was Larry Fink, who ran BlackRock, he was tapped by our Treasury Department to hand out, kind of relief packages to corporations that were going bankrupt after 2008, the 2008 financial collapse. And he said, I will give you the money if you go woke, and I'm going to give you these certain platforms, that you should hit and to raise your social credit score. And by the way, to be able to make sure that you're complying with these new woke agendas, I want to basically have all of your information in my computer system, Aladdin. And so now he has backdoor inside information to every corporation. That's largely the goal. By the way, his corporation, BlackRock, has, at last count, $13 trillion in assets, which makes them the third most powerful institution on planet Earth behind the United States and China.
You mentioned your book. I've read it. It's great. How can people get it?
Oh, not necessary. Go to Amazon.com or anything like that, or you can go to my website, actionableethics.com. But more importantly, go to thenewamerican.com. That has a plethora of information, and you'll learn all these things. Like that great video by Alex Newman.
Absolutely. So thank you, Daniel. We're going to go to a break now, and I will be back with Dr. Duke Pesta.
Thank you for having me.
Hello, I'm Brandon House, and thank you for watching WVWTV.com. If you appreciate this 24-hour-a-day free broadcast platform, will you consider supporting us? One way you can support us to keep pushing out free programming to people all over the world is by joining in partnership with WVW Foundation. The WVW Foundation exists to proclaim the truth of a biblical worldview, to help people understand the times through the lens of a biblical worldview. If you appreciate that, we appreciate your partnering with WVWFoundation.com. That's WVWFoundation.com. If you prefer to support us through the mail, the mailing address is WVW Foundation, P.O. Box 1690, Collierville, Tennessee, 38027. If you prefer to support us over the phone, you can make a contribution by calling 901-468-9357. That's 901-468-9357. Your support of the WVW Foundation, as I said, allows us to push out free programming. Many people put their programming behind a paywall. If you don't catch it live, you don't get to see it. WVW Foundation is committed to working with WVW Broadcast Network to push out programming as a ministry of the foundation. The foundation also sponsors a Sunday night service that I've been hosting since 2015. If you'd like to join us for our Sunday night service, you can do so every Sunday night, 8 p.m. Central Time at WVWTV.com/live. WVWTV.com/live. Thanks again for your support of the WVW Foundation at WVWFoundation.com.
The John Birch Society has been working tirelessly since 1958 to preserve freedom, safeguard the Constitution, and restore our God-given rights. We continually educate voters and lead the freedom movement. Join us as we work against a tyrannical one-world government. United as one, we can defeat this conspiracy against a free America. JBS founder Robert Welch said, education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon. Join us in restoring this great nation.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
The truth is hard to find, but the New American has it. Check it out at thenewamerican.com.
Welcome back, and thanks for joining us for The New American TV. I'm your host, Rebecca Terrell, and this we're bringing you the truth behind the news. And with me, joining me right now, is Dr. Duke Pesta of Freedom Project Academy up in Appleton, Wisconsin. Dr. Duke, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's great to have you on. Well, Dr. Duke, you are an accomplished speaker. You are an educational reformer in the good sense of the word. You've been a college professor. You've been a high school teacher. And now you're the administrator of Freedom Project Academy. I want you to tell our viewers what that is all about.
Well, we are an alternative to the public schools. I am still, unfortunately, in many ways, a university professor as well. So I see every day how kids come to public universities completely unprepared for school. My senior English majors have about a ninth grade reading level. So about 12 years ago, we decided to create an online public school from kindergarten, an online school to rival the public schools. Sure. From kindergarten all the way through high school. And what's unique about our online school is we don't just give you discs or recordings. I think we're still the only school that really does this. We have really live teachers teaching in real time, again, from kindergarten to high school, and we have all the subjects you can imagine, and the kids have 25, 30 other kids in the class from all across the country and the world. We simulate a classroom environment where kids can talk to each other, they can talk to teacher. So the technology is allowing us to create an actual classroom with kids interacting with themselves, with each other, with the teacher, and giving them classical Christian education as well. And that's kind of a really big deal.
Absolutely it is. In fact, I have 8 nieces and nephews who are all students or graduates of Freedom Project Academy. And I have to say, you know, you mentioned a little earlier, you established the academy to rival public schools. It's not hard to rival public schools. I would say Freedom Project Academy is a rival to the best education out there in any college prep organization at all. And I know that personally because I know what kind of education my nieces and nephews have gotten. In fact, I told one of them the other day, one of the graduates, I said, I'm going to have you on the show one day to talk about her experience. You know, it's a beautiful thing. And, you know, they've gone on to college and they're studying electronic engineering and chemical engineering, and they're prepared for that kind of career. It's a fantastic program because it is based on classical education. And let's talk about that for a second and why that is so important to combat that common core that's out there.
Well, please put your nieces in touch with us. They could make a great commercial for us. We could use that. But classical education is the way to do it. Classical education is basically education where teachers and administrators and state education bureaucrats don't force worldview, sexuality, let the mom and dads raise the kids. We just teach kids to read, to write, and to encounter the great minds in human history through books. That's what we do. And if we just did that, this country would be 100% better shape, heading in the right way. But we haven't been doing that for over 50 years.
Absolutely. And it teaches the classical education teaches kids not what to think. It's not propaganda. It teaches them how to think. And this really came home, the niece that I was speaking about just a few minutes ago, who's now a graduate, when she was very young, I had her and a couple of her siblings out at a restaurant. You know, you can't get away from screens wherever you go. We are 1984 now, and the screens are always shouting at you. And we were in a booth at the restaurant, and SpongeBob SquarePants came on the TV, and I noticed her looking at it. She'd never seen anything like, because we always kept, you know, we kept screens away from the kids so they would learn how to think correctly, and gave them the classical education that the FPA offers so they would learn how to think correctly. She took one look at that. She said to me, "What is that?" But I told her, and she said, that's not good. I thought, this is great that she was a young girl and she was thinking correctly. This is not a good thing for anyone to watch. And that, you know, that just kind of drove it home to me, because people are always saying, oh, if you try to shelter children, they won't be ready for the real world once they get out into it. That's a lie. It's just the opposite is true. Shelter them when they are young and innocent, and don't expose them to all that perversion that we get out in society and in education, especially now in our public schools.
You make a great point. And the real world to progressives is a hellscape, isn't it? It's a hellscape where children are sexualized, where 13-year-old girls are cutting their breasts off, where you have pedophilia and a whole host of goofy stuff. Think about the reality of progressivism, which is it's something out of George Orwell. Yeah. Think about reality when kids used to get good books the last 2,000 years. Yeah. They turned out those kids created the United States of America. Those kids fed liberty and individuality. Those kids were the ones who wrote, who completely revolutionized freedom and liberty. So when you, reality changes, and Abraham Lincoln made this clear, right? That what you teach kids in just one generation becomes how the entire country goes the next. When those kids grow up, they change everything.
Right.
And we go back to teaching.
It was Vladimir Lenin said something along those lines, too. He said, give me one generation and I'll have the country. Right.
Yep. And Hitler said the same thing. Give us the elementary schools and we will your children will own you. And so, yes. And so reality, I love when the progressives use that word because they're the least realistic people in the world.
Yes.
But reality, when you give kids a Christian education and a classical model that allows them to think critically, you get the United States of America. When you don't, you get a bunch of young kids who want to tear it down.
I'll tell you what, my niece just got through with some C++ programming class. I think she said that it was so much easier because of your logic class there with FPA. And it's that kind of classical, that's real, true education that you get. Tell us for a minute how people can get in touch with FPA and get their kids involved.
Well, go to fpeusa.org because that's where you can see all of our curriculum. We are a ministry. And I know you know this because your kids, your family has been with us. We are a ministry, not just a school. And that means that you could, if you want to homeschool, you don't want to take Freedom Project, you want to do it yourself, you can go to our website. You could see every book that we teach for every grade. By all means, take it. Give these kids books to your kids. Books to your kids. So take what we've got that's free. Everything that we do is there. You can see. And so come to fpeusa.org. You can learn about school. We will be enrolling for the fall of 2023, starting in April. So from April through basically the end of June, you can sign up for a whole, we can do a whole year worth of school. We could give you five classes a week, like just like the public schools, or we could just do a single class for you if you just want a little help with history or chemistry.
Wonderful. That is fantastic. And that is FPE. I've been saying FPA, and I want to make sure that everybody is very clear. I say FPA because it's Freedom Project Academy, but your website is FPE, correct?
Yes, for Freedom Project Education, of which the Academy is part, fpeusa.org.
I'm using the slang because that's what the kids, that's what my nieces and nephews always say. So didn't want to confuse everyone.
My wife is Southern, and she has an accent kind of like yours, so the A sounds like an E anyway.
I'm trying not to let that. So I promised everyone I wouldn't sound like Petticoat Junction on this show, but I guess that you can't get the Southern out of that accent. So yes, I'm from Memphis, Tennessee. So there you
there
have
you
it.
Go.
All right, you've outed me.
Hey, I now that I've lived with my wife for all these years, it's so much more mellifluous than other kinds of accents. So don't change it. Don't change it.
You're very kind. Well, I do appreciate it, and I appreciate you taking the time. I know how busy you are. Let's get you back in April when y'all are starting to enroll, and we'll try to drum up some business for you because we need our children educated properly because they are our future. If we don't invest in them, we're going to lose the battle.
Thanks so much for having us. And we could talk to you about all kinds of education issues anytime you want us to.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Pesto. I will talk to you very, very soon.
And have a good day.
You too. Wonderful to be with you. And stay with us because we are going to have a very important interview in our second half of our program. It is with Congressman Thomas Massey of Kentucky. He's talking about the Fed and his bill to audit the Fed. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Hi, I'm Alan Keyes. I'm the host of IMTV's daily talk show about news and events in America. And I want to say a good word for the New American Magazine. Not only because Alex Newman has joined us as somebody who is periodically hosting a show, but because New American Magazine represents an alternative media that is willing to tell people the truth. With so much fake news spreading about, and the fact that right now this country's in an existential crisis, we remember who we are and where we come from and what our principles are, or we die. Reading New American Magazine can keep you up to the minute on the issues that are challenging us as a people and on which that survival hangs. You can check it out and subscribe at www.thenewamerican.com.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution.
What we need are just more people that would read the one we have.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
Who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand when necessary.
As a lumberjack, I've been cutting wood for decades. My job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. My axe goes through every time. You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things? And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. They say I'm part of a global plan. I don't think so. It's too hot, it's too cold. You know what? The weather changes. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Visit thenewamerican.com and subscribe to get 50% off the cover price. And if you want an even better deal, use the promo code 10OFFSUB. Again, that's 10OFFSUB for more than 50% off.
Welcome back to the New American TV, where we give you the truth behind the news. You probably know that Ron Paul has been pushing for an audit the Fed movement for years and years and years. Now we have Congressman Thomas Massey of Kentucky, who has introduced a bill to accomplish that same objective. The New American's Christian Gomez sat down with Congressman Massey recently, and we are going to air his interview with him right now. So here we go.
So about a month ago, or over a month ago on Christmas Eve, Congress passed a massive $1.6 to $1.7 trillion spending bill. That was the last major spending bill that was passed under Nancy Pelosi's speakership and the Democrats controlling both of the legislative chambers. And you and 199 other Republicans voted against that monstrosity of an omnibus. But now that Republicans control just the House of Representatives, of course, not the Senate and the White House, does this division now mean that we're likely to see government shutdowns in the future? Or are Republicans going to end up acquiescing to Biden and Schumer's spending demands? What's your plan or strategy to prevent another one of these $1.6, $1.7 trillion spending bills from passing again?
Well, first of all, that's legislative malpractice, the $1.7 trillion spending bill, where they put everything together, all 12 appropriations bills stuffed into one, plus extra stuff. Like Ukraine spending and a few other extra things in there that don't even belong in a spending bill were in that omnibus bill. And by the way, that
The spending bills were due September 30th. So there were two CRs and then that spending bill. So the Democrats came to the brink of a shutdown three times when they controlled both houses of Congress and the White House. And there's a lot of hand-wringing now because Republicans have one half of one third of the government in our control, that something like a spending cut might happen. And that's what I would like to see. Now, there are going to be two big, I guess there'll be showdowns coming up. One will be raising the debt limit, and one will be passing the 12 separate spending bills. As part of the negotiations that were going on when Kevin was elected as Speaker, we got guarantees that we would pass all 12 separate bills, that conservatives would be allowed to offer amendments to cut spending on all 12 of those bills, and that we would force the Senate to take them up. Now, an idea that I have proposed that it seems to be popular within the conference, and it might be consummated here as a consequence of raising the debt limit, might be part of that deal, is for the House to go ahead and pass a continuing resolution that funds the government at 99% on October 1st. Now, let me unpack that. I've never voted for a continuing resolution myself. I hate them. It's basically like a cut, copy, paste of the last omnibus. But I thought to myself, how could I vote for a CR? Well, if it cut government 1%, which seems to be a pretty modest proposal to me, and it only kicks in if the 12 separate appropriations bills aren't taken up by the Senate and signed by Joe Biden, it's a really good backstop. Because here's what would happen on September 30th, where the next showdown, shutdown showdown, let me call it that, that's going to happen, will be September 30th at midnight if 12 separate appropriations bills aren't passed. CNN, if the House adopts my plan, CNN won't be able to put a countdown clock on the screen that says 24 hours until all of government shuts down. The countdown clock would have to say 24 hours until all discretionary spending takes a 1% haircut. And that way we take shutdown off the table. We are the adults in the room. And the Senate will hopefully be, by the way, Christian, the threat of flat funding here terrifies these people. The threat of using last year's number terrifies them. So the idea that we would have a 1% cut if they fail to act on our 12 bills is extreme motivation, I believe, for the Senate to come to the table. And that's what I would like to see us get maybe on this debt limit increase, is not necessarily a policy change, but and I know people aren't excited about this, but I'm super excited after being here 10 years about this. What we need to get is a way in which we negotiate these things when we get to the brink so that we can win instead of losing.
So is the entire Republican conference behind this strategy of yours? Have they embraced it fully? Or is that still being worked on?
I rolled this out in November and December. And I've brought it up again here recently. Jim Jordan's a big fan of it and promotes it in the meetings that I'm not in because he is chairman. And Kevin McCarthy seems to be a fan of it. Now, when you say, is the whole conference behind it, I presume you mean, are there 218 behind it, which is almost the same thing as the whole conference since we have 222 in the majority. There is broad support. I would say 90%+, support it. Can I guarantee there aren't five who would oppose it? In this majority, there's no way you could guarantee that. I think, I'd like to find out. I'd like to put it to a vote. I think there's a good chance they would support it.
What did Kevin McCarthy think about this plan when you proposed it to him?
He was a big fan of it in December, even before it got written down in the negotiations. By the way, this is part of the negotiations that happened 2 weeks ago, was that we would do something like this. And, there's in the 15 rounds of voting, it was hard to get really specific because not everybody was at the table to agree to the sort of things that compelled the 20 and a half members to eventually let Kevin McCarthy be speaker, some by voting present, some by voting for Kevin. But as we hammer out those details, Kevin seems to be a fan of it. And I think he's got to be a fan of things that unite the conference and help us win the messaging war. Because this, you know, some of the biggest fans of my plan are the members who are from the purple districts or the districts that Joe Biden won by 4 points, because they need to have a credible plan that people don't, that doesn't cause them to get unelected in their general election, but also shows the conservatives who are going to pick who wins the primary that they are also fighting for fiscal responsibility. And by the way, Christian, this is basically the penny plan, okay? That's what this is, but reduced to practice, and only as a backstop. Only as a backstop if we can't get the 12 separate bills taken up by the Senate and signed by Joe Biden. The penny plan kicks in, and it doesn't touch Social Security or Medicare. It's so modest that I'm almost ashamed to tell you it was my idea.
Speaking of the $1.6, $1.7 trillion spending bill that was passed, you mentioned that it had funding for Ukraine. Almost $47 billion in aid went to Ukraine in just that one omnibus. So at this point, we've sent at least over $100 billion in aid to Ukraine. Is the new House majority interested in providing any precise clarity as to where this money is exactly going in Ukraine, what it's being used for?
Well, I think we should have an inspector general, you know, auditing every penny. And by audit, I mean, you don't just look at the books. You go inspect the equipment. If we've paid for something, you go take inventory. This is what a real audit means. Now, I wouldn't have voted to send a penny there. And so that position might seem radical to some here in Washington, D.C. It actually seems to be the norm in Northern Kentucky for the 750,000 people I represent. But I think, regardless of whether you think the money should have gone there or not, I believe most people understand that the only right thing to do once it's there or once it's been voted on to go there is to make sure that it's going where you intended for it to go. We had such a office in Afghanistan to monitor the roughly $50 billion a year that went there. Now we're talking about twice as much money per year going to Ukraine. And if we had an inspector general in Afghanistan, we need one in Ukraine.
Of course, and sadly, a lot of what we sent in terms of military equipment into Afghanistan is now in the hands of the Taliban. So we certainly wouldn't want, whether you're for aid or against aid, we wouldn't want any equipment that we do send to get into the hands of the Russians. And speaking of equipment being sent, what is your opinion about the U.S. sending M1 Abrams tanks and Germany sending Leopard tanks to Ukraine? Do you see that as an escalation to the conflict over there?
It's not a good development. I don't think we should be doing it. If they wanted to buy them, I suppose we could sell them to them. But for us to provide them is bad. And, you know, some people would argue there's a distinction between providing defensive weapons and offensive weapons. Obviously, tanks could be used in an offensive. I mean, that's the way Russia has used their tanks. So these are weapons that can be used in an offensive manner. And if, you know, they went into Russian territory using tanks that we gave them, if there was any doubt before that we're co-combatants, there would be no doubt at that point, I think. And I think it's a dangerous position to be in, to be co-combatants with somebody who's fighting a nuclear power. I think it's somewhat ridiculous for us to hem ourselves in and to say that our only conditions for dropping our support is if Putin is overthrown or takes a bullet to the head. And while we're sending Abrams tanks in, it's a terrible position for America to take. I think we should be trying to encourage some kind of negotiated settlement there.
Of course, and heeding the advice of the founders to steer clear from foreign entanglements as well. Last year, we saw the Democrats run a very highly partisan committee, the January 6th committee. And J6 has become something of a Rorschach test, if you will, where the left believes it was this failed insurrection by conservatives, and conservatives see it kind of as a question mark. So in your estimation, what transparency in the new House majority, sorry, is the new House majority willing to give the American people on the question of January 6th specifically? Do you think that Kevin McCarthy is willing to release the 14,000 hours of unreleased video footage of what actually happened that day, showing government agents allowing Americans to go in and so forth? What are your thoughts on transparency from the January 6th investigations?
I think we should have total transparency. Release all of those videos. Release a list of not just the people that we know about who were in uniform that were letting the protesters into the Capitol. Release a list of the protesters who were working with the government. Let us know who those people were. Identify them in the videos. And, I've asked Merrick Garland in sworn testimony, he was sworn in, how many agents or assets of the federal government were present on January 5th and January 6th and agitating to go into the Capitol? Just answer that question. He refused to answer the question. So I would be completely transparent about it and let the chips fall where they may.
Absolutely. And speaking of House committees, you'll be serving on the newly created Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government, which many Republicans are comparing to the 1975 Church Committee, formed by Senate Democrats and led by Senator Frank Church of Idaho back at the time, to investigate government intelligence agencies. So, Congressman Massey, do you see this new committee as an opportunity here to do something equaling sort of the informative impact of what the Church and Pike committees unveiled at the time? And if the new committee finds any evidence of government malfeasance, how confident are you that there will be any consequences, especially with Merrick Garland, as you mentioned, being in charge of the Justice Department and the Biden administration still controlling at least the executive branch of government?
Well, a lot to unpack there. It feels like there were five questions, and if I don't answer them all, feel free to re-ask them. But the first one that I got out of that was, is this an opportunity? This is an amazing opportunity. This is one of the biggest opportunities that I've had since in the 10 years that I've been in Congress to uncover not government incompetence, but government malfeasance, particularly with the intent of suppressing the civil liberties of the American people. Let me tell you what I don't think it should be. I don't think it should be a relitigation of the last election. I don't think it should become about any one particular politician. I think this is about the American people. Have their civil liberties, whether it's freedom of religion, freedom to assemble, freedom of speech, right to keep and bear arms, life, liberty, and property, privacy, have any of those rights been violated by the federal government in a willful manner? And uncovering that. So it's a great opportunity. I hope we don't blow it. Behind the doors here, when this camera turns off, I am in that committee fighting to make sure that it is real, that it's not some kind of show committee. Now, the biggest obstacle we're gonna have, obviously, and this is when you'll know whether it's, you'll get an indication of whether it's serious or not, is that the executive branch will try to obfuscate, they will try to delay. We have 2 years to do this, but they will try to tie us up when we issue subpoenas. They'll refuse stuff, they'll say they don't have it, they'll say it's the subject of an ongoing investigation, et cetera, all of those things. What we need to tell them is we will cut your funding. Your department will no longer exist on October 1st, or it'll be, half the size, whatever it takes to compel them to come to the table. Now, another one of your questions in there is, will it lead to changes? Will something actually be done as a result of this? This committee will happen in stages. We have to do investigations. Not all of those will be open to the public. We need to find if there's there. Then bring it out in open hearings. Bring those people who were responsible for it in front of the TV cameras. Compel them to answer our questions live on TV so the American people can decide. Ultimately, it's also going to be up to the American people. You know, if the voters aren't upset, if the constituents aren't upset and compelled to tell their congressman to do something about this, then I'm going to just tell you right now, the majority of congressmen up here won't do anything unless they're pressed to do it. So the hearings hopefully will compel the public to pressure Congress to do things. Now, one technical aspect of the organization of this committee is that it's a select committee, but it's a subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee. There was some debate over whether it should stand on its own, like the January 6th committee did, or, you know, would it be hemmed in or constrained as a subcommittee of a standing committee? Let me tell you the benefit of it being a subcommittee of a standing committee. The Judiciary Committee, on which I also serve, has authorization authority for the spending. So I think it's good that the parent committee of the Select Committee can withhold money from the DOJ and the FBI and ATF. Those are the organizations that we have funding authorization for. So we have an advantage there. But also, to your question, after we uncover things, if we find anything, if there is a legislative fix, it resides within the authorizations for the DOJ or the FBI or the ATF. We are already a subcommittee of the committee that is duly authorized to, with jurisdiction, to oversee and legislate the authorities of the FBI and DOJ. Let me remind your viewers, Congress created the Department of Justice. It's not in the Constitution. It's not a branch in the Constitution. Congress created the FBI. These are creations of Congress. We can uncreate them. We can recreate them. And that authority is in the Judiciary Committee, which is the parent committee of the Select Committee.
Speaking of uncreating things created by Congress, back in December 30th, you tweeted, is part of a series of tweets, he tweeted, quote, repeal of the three acts of 1913, referring to the Federal Reserve Act, the 16th and 17th Amendments. So repeal of the three acts of 1913, violent toward our republic, would obviate any need or want for a term limit amendment and a balanced budget amendment. The document our founders gave us was genius, and we tamper with it at our own peril. Could you elaborate further on this and why you believe term limits and a balanced budget amendment aren't, why they're not really a good idea?
Well, the founders actually didn't trust the people to elect senators. And the senators were supposed to be representatives of the states. So I think if you're not happy with the elections every year and you think term limits is the answer, well, then go back and look at what happened with the 17th Amendment. Actually, the founders knew better already. So if the 17th Amendment, which is the direct election of senators, hadn't happened, then you wouldn't need term limits or think you need term limits for senators. The balanced budget amendment, the 16th Amendment was sort of our undoing. The states used to be responsible for the federal debt. The states used to have to come up with the taxes before you had direct taxation of people. The federal government now just reaches right past the states and takes the money from the people. And that is what has allowed this crazy amount of spending. And then the Federal Reserve is the thing that facilitates this deficit spending. And just, you know, while we're coming up on whether we raise the debt limit and by how much and what concessions we might get for raising the debt limit, the debt limit is already the balanced budget constraint in Congress. The all of the balanced budget amendments that I've seen offered on the floor of the House have some sort of safety fuse that are loopholes big enough to drive a truck through So, for instance, the one we passed a few years ago when we were in the majority said that if you had a 60-vote majority, that you could override the balanced budget amendment to the Constitution that they had proposed. Well, just that same week, or within a week of then, they passed, they raised the debt limit or passed an unbalanced budget with over 60 members of Congress. And in the Senate, it's already a requirement. So the balanced budget amendment, it kind of already exists. It's the debt limit, okay? And we're about to vote to undo the debt limit. So if you have a balanced budget amendment that allows Congress to vote to undo it, they're going to undo it. The other problem with the balanced budget amendments I've seen, I know we're running out of time, is they usually have an exemption for war. Well, the first thing Congress will do every 2 years is elect a speaker, adopt the rules package, and declare war on some unfortunate third world country so that they can engage in deficit spending if that's a loophole for the balanced budget amendment. So, I mean, I'm not necessarily against those things, but let's be smart. Let's recognize there are already constraints and Congress gets out of them. And if you put loopholes in a balanced budget amendment, Congress is going to use them just like they do right now to raise the debt limit.
So you'd rather see Congress have pass a clean repeal of the 16th and 17th Amendment and a clean repeal of the Federal Reserve Act versus, let's say, having a constitutional convention where we don't know what would come out of it, where people would be proposing like a balanced budget amendment and term limits, which wouldn't even fix the problem, essentially.
Absolutely. Repeal 1913. Just repeal everything that happened there because it all went hand in hand. Direct election of senators went with direct taxation of people. The senators quit representing the states that year, and the federal government could start ignoring the states because the senators weren't elected by the states, and the federal government didn't need revenue from the states to function anymore. It created its own source through the Federal Reserve, the printing of money, and also through the direct taxation of people. It was a severe blow to our republic.
I want to ask you one last question. I know we're really out of time, but the last question is simply this. Speaking of potentially repealing the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, you've made a step towards that potentially with the introduction of your bill, H.R. 24, the Federal Reserve Transparency Act. And I noticed that Congressman Eric Burleson and Jim Jordan and Brian Donalds have all signed on to it recently. Could you briefly just summarize the tenets of that bill and what you believe the full scope of the audit would be or should be, assuming it was to pass?
There's a lot to unpack here. I don't know how much time you have, but let me just sort of dip my toe in it. The Federal Reserve's never undergone a full audit. Now, you got two groups of people who oppose my bill. Those who say that it's already audited, and so they don't need an audit, and those who say if you audit it, then it'll change the way it behaves, that it needs to operate in secret and the markets can't influence it and Congress can't influence it, it can't be open to political pressure that an audit would expose. Well, both of those arguments can't be true. That they're already undergoing an audit is one argument, and the other argument is if you do audit it, it will change the nature and the way in which it works. They're just smoke screens is what they are. There's a perfunctory audit that doesn't really uncover the way they make decisions. And we need to know that. All the authority that's vested in the Federal Reserve came from Congress. Like you can delegate authority, but you can't delegate responsibility. And we're still responsible for that. So we need to know what they're doing. Now, there's this other argument that they're independent. Give me a break. They may be independent of Congress, but they're not independent of the bankers in Wall Street. All of the heads of the Federal Reserve and the heads of their various banks, the regional banks, they come from industry and they're going to go back to industry. They come from banking and investment banking. They're going to go back into those industries, or they come from Treasury, and the Treasury and the Federal Reserve communicate every day. Every minute of every day, they are in constant communication. Don't tell me the Federal Reserve is independent of the executive branch. They're printing money and buying the debt off of each other. And you can't say that, oh, we're just going to print some money and lay it here on the street corner, and then maybe somebody will come and borrow it, and then we're not coordinating. Of course they coordinate every minute of every day. So Congress needs to get back in there. This is a gift to the executive branch. Basically we've given up our power to the executive branch, and it's to industry, to the bankers. We need to reassert it. An audit would do that. And once you do the audit, you may find that you need to end it. And so I'm glad to have those co-sponsors. And this bill has passed. It's passed out of the Oversight Committee. Once when I was on the Oversight Committee, and we got it to the floor, it even passed the floor of the House when Paul Brown was the sponsor. And the senators, they are... we just, you know, occasionally some of my colleagues run for Senate, some of my colleagues in the House, and they get elected. And I have a few weeks to spend with them before they transition over in the Senate. And there was a recent one, I believe it's Peter Welch from Vermont, said, who I have great respect for. He's co-sponsored this bill. He was on the Oversight Committee with me, so it was significant that he co-sponsored it. We got it passed. I said, don't be one of those guys who sponsors this bill in the House and then gets to the Senate, wink, wink, nod, nod, not going to name names, Bernie Sanders maybe, who gets to the Senate and then doesn't vote for it and doesn't support it once they become a senator. And I'm picking on Welch at the moment, but there are other senators who've done that, who have given the same admonishment too. So we can get this out of the House. They're often Democrat sponsors for it. It passes with an overwhelming bipartisan majority. So the fact that we've only got 222 Republicans shouldn't be a problem. The problem's going to be in the Senate, where you have people who, once something happens in the water, you know, 300 yards from here, they become senators and they don't sponsor this or vote for it anymore.
Well, we've certainly covered a lot of ground today. Thank you so much for your time. We know that you're really busy. And thank you for everything that you're doing in Congress to protect American liberties as well. Take care, Congressman Massey, and God bless you.
God bless you and your listeners, Christian. Thanks.
Thank you.
And that is all the time we have today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for the New American TV, where we report the truth behind the news. And we will be here every day at 2 o'clock Central in collaboration with Worldview Weekend Television. I encourage you, we follow all of these topics daily at thenewamerican.com, so please join us there. And also, if you want to know what to do about saving our constitutional republic, we don't want to just be the most educated prisoner in the prison camp, join us at jbs.org, because we have the recipe, the template for saving our constitution and restoring freedom. We'll see you back here next week. And in the meantime, have a great weekend and God bless.